There's a bar like it in every town. It's dimly lit, and the drinkers, although they talk, don't address their words to one another, and they don't listen either. They just talk the hurt inside. It's a bar for the derelict and the unlucky, and all of those people who have been temporarily flagged off the racetrack of life and into the pits. It always does a brisk trade. On this dawn, the mourners sat ranged along the counter, each in his cloud of gloom, each certain that he was the most unfortunate individual in the whole world.
"I created it," said Silverfish morosely. "I thought it would be educational. It could broaden people's horizons. I didn't intend for it to be a show with 1,000 elephants," he added nastily. "Yeah," said Detritus, "she don't know what she wants." "I do what she want. Then she say that not right. You a troll with no finer feeling. You do not understand what a girl wants. She say, girl wants sticky things to eat in box with bow round. I make box with bow round. She open box. She scream. She say flayed horse is not what she mean. She don't know what she wants."
"Yeah," said a voice from under Silverfish's stool. "It'd serve 'em all right if I went off and joined the wolves."
"I mean, take this blown-away thing," said Silverfish. "It's not even real. It's not like things really were. It's just lies. Anyone can tell lies."
"Yeah," said Detritus. "Like she say, girl wants music under window. I play music under window. Everyone in street wake up and shouting out of the house. You bad troll, what you hitting rocks this time of night?" And she never even wake up.
"Yeah," said Silverfish. "Yeah," said Detritus.
"Yeah," said the voice under the stool. The man who ran the bar was naturally cheerful. It wasn't hard to be cheerful, really, when your customers acted like lightning rods for any misery that happened to be floating around. He'd found that it wasn't a good idea to say things like, "Never mind, look on the bright side," because there never was one, or "Cheer up, it may never happen," because often it already had. All that was expected of him was to keep the drink coming. He was a little puzzled this morning, though. There seemed to be an extra person in the bar, quite apart from whoever it was speaking up from the floor. He kept getting the feeling that he was serving an extra drink, and even getting paid for it, and even talking to the mysterious purchaser, but he couldn't see him. In fact, he wasn't quite sure what he was seeing, or who he was talking to. He wandered down to the far end of the bar. A glass slid towards him.
"Same again," said a voice out of the shadows.
Said the barman.
"Yep, sure. What was it?"
"Anything."
The barman filled it with rum. It was pulled away. The barman sought for something to say. For some reason, he was feeling terrified.
"Don't see you in here much," he managed.
"I come for the atmosphere. Same again."
"Working in Holywood, do you?"
said the barman, topping up the glass quickly. It vanished again.
"Not for some time. Same again."
The barman hesitated. He was at heart a kindly soul.
"You don't think you've had enough, do you?" he said.
"I know exactly when I've had enough."
"Everyone says that, though."
"I know when everyone's had enough."
There was something very odd about that voice. The barman wasn't quite sure that he was hearing it with his ears.
"Oh, well, he said. "Same again?"
"No. Busy day tomorrow. Keep the change."
A handful of coins slid across the counter. They felt icy cold, and most of them were heavily corroded.
Oh,
the barman began. The door opened and shut, letting in a cold blast of air despite the warmth of the night. The barman wiped the top of the bar in a distracted way, carefully avoiding the coins.
"You see some funny types running a bar," he muttered.
The voice by his ear said,
"I forgot. A packet of nuts, please."
Snow glittered on the rimward outriders of the Ramtop Mountains. that great world-spanning range which, where it curves around the Circle Sea, forms a natural wall between Klatch and the great flat Stowe Plains. It was the home of rogue glaciers and prowling avalanches and high, silent fields of snow. And yetis. Yetis are a high-altitude species of troll, and quite unaware that eating people is out of fashion. Their view is, if it moves, eat it. If it doesn't, then wait for it to move, and then eat it. They'd been listening all day to the sounds. Echoes had bounced from peak to peak along the frozen ranges until now it was a steady, dull rumble.
"My cousin," said one of them, idly probing a hollow tooth with a claw, "said they was enormous grey animals. Elephants."
"Bigger than us?" said the other yeti.
"Nearly as bigger than us," said the first yeti. "Loads of them," he said. "More than he could count."
The second yeti sniffed the wind and appeared to consider this.
"Yeah, well," he said gloomily,
"your cousin can't count above one. He said there was lots of ones, big, fat, grey elephants, all climbing, all roped together, big and slow, all carrying loads of ugra."
"Oh."
The first yeti indicated the vast, sloping snowfield.
"Good and deep today," he said. "Nothing's gonna move fast in this, right? We lie down in the snow. They won't see us till they're right on top of us. We panic 'em. It's big eats time."
He waved his enormous paws in the air.
"Very heavy," my cousin said. "They'll not move fast, you mark my words."
The other yeti shrugged.
"Let's do it,"
he said, against the sound of distant, terrified trumpeting. They lay down in the snow, their white hides turning them into two unsuspicious mounds. It was a technique that had worked time and again, and had been handed down from yeti to yeti for thousands of years. Although it wasn't going to be handed much further. They waited. There was a distant bellowing as the herd approached. Eventually, the first yeti said, very slowly, because it had been working this out for a long time,
"What do you get, right? What do you get if you cross a mountain with an elephant?"
It never got an answer. The yetis had been right. When 500 crude two-elephant bobsleighs crested the ridge 10 feet away at 60 miles an hour, their strapped-on occupants trumpeting in panic, they never saw the yetis until they were right on top of them. Victor got only 2 hours' sleep, but got up feeling remarkably refreshed and optimistic. It was all over. Things were going to be a whole lot better now. Ginger had been quite nice to him last night, well, a few hours ago, and whatever it was in the hill had been well and truly buried. You got that sort of thing sometimes, he thought, as he poured some water into the cracked basin and had a quick wash. Some wicked old king or wizard gets buried and their spirit creeps about, trying to put things right or something. Well-known effect. But now there must be a million tons of rock blocking the tunnel, and I can't see anyone doing any creeping through that. The unpleasantly alive screen surfaced briefly in his memory, but even that didn't seem so bad now. It had been dark in there. There had been lots of moving shadows. He had been wound up like a spring in any case. No wonder his eyes had played tricks on him. There had been the skeletons, too, but even they now lacked the power to terrify. Victor had heard of tribal leaders up on the cold plains who'd be buried with whole armies of mounted horsemen so that their souls would live on in the next world. Maybe there was something like that here once. Yes, it all seemed much less horrifying in the cold light of day. And that's just what it was. Cold light. The room was full of the kind of light you got when you woke up on a winter's morning and knew by the light that it had snowed. It was a light without shadows. He went to the window and looked out on a pale silver glow. Holy Wood had vanished. The visions of the night fountained up in his mind again, as the darkness returns when the light goes out. "Hang on, hang on," he thought, fighting the panic. "It's only fog. You're bound to get fog sometimes, this close to the sea. And it's glowing like that because the sun's out. There's nothing occult about fog. It's just fine drops of water floating in the air. That's all it is." He dragged his clothes on and threw open the door to the passage and almost tripped over Gaspode, who had been lying full length in front of the door like the world's most unwashed draft excluder. The little dog raised himself unsteadily on his front paws, fixed Victor with a yellow eye, and said,
"I just want you to know, all right, that I ain't lying in front of your door because of any of this loyal dog protecting his master nonsense, okay? It's just that when I got back here..." "Oh, shut up, Gaspode."
Victor opened the outer door. Fog drifted in. It seemed to have an exploratory feel to it. It came in as if it had been waiting for just this opportunity.
"Fog's just fog," he said aloud. "Come on, we're going to Ankh-Morpork today, remember?"
"My head," said Gaspode. "My head feels like the bottom of a cat's basket."
"You can sleep on the coach. I can sleep on the coach if it comes to that."
He took a few steps into the silvery glow and was almost immediately lost. Buildings loomed vaguely at him in the thick, clammy air. "Gaspode," he said hesitantly.
"Fog's just fog," he repeated. "But it feels crowded.
It feels like that if it suddenly went away, I'd see lots of people watching me. From outside. And that's ridiculous, because I am outside, so there's nothing outside of outside.
And it's flickering."
"I expect you'll be wanting me to lead the way," said a smug voice by his knee.
"It's very quiet, isn't it?" said Victor, trying to sound nonchalant.
"I expect it's the fog muffling everything." "Of course, maybe ghastly creatures have come up out of the sea and murdered every mortal soul except us," said Gaspode conversationally.
"Shut up!"
Something loomed up out of the brightness. As it got closer, it got smaller, and the tentacles and antennae that Victor's imagination had been furnishing became the more or less ordinary arms and legs of Sol Dibbler.
"Victor?" he said uncertainly.
"Sol?"
Sol's relief was visible.
"Can't see a thing of this stuff," he said. "We thought you'd got lost. Come on, it's nearly noon. We're more or less ready to go."
"I'm ready."
"Good."
Fog droplets had condensed on Sol's hair and clothing. He said,
"Where are we, exactly?"
Victor turned round. His lodgings had been behind him.
"The fog changes everything, doesn't it?" said Sol unhappily. "Do you think your little dog can find his way to the studio? He seems quite bright."
"Growl, growl,"
said Gaspode, and sat up and begged in what Victor at least recognised as a sarcastic way.
"My word," said Sol. "It's as if he understands, isn't it?"
Gaspode barked sharply. After a second or two, there was a barrage of excited answering barks.
"Of course, that'll be Laddie," said Sol. "What a clever dog!"
Gaspode looked smug.
"Mind you, that's Laddie in a nutshell," said Sol as they set off towards the barking. "I expect he could teach your dog a few tricks, eh?"
Victor didn't dare look down. After a few false turns, the archway of Century of the Fruit Bat passed overhead like a ghost. There were more people here. The site seemed to be filling up with lost wanderers who didn't know where else to go. There was a coach waiting outside Dibbler's office, and Dibbler himself stood beside it, stamping his feet.
"Come on, come on," he said. "I've sent Gaffer ahead with the film. Get in, the pair of you."
"Can we travel in this?" said Victor.
"What's to go wrong?" said Dibbler. "There's one road to Ankh-Morpork. Anyway, we'll probably be well out of this stuff when we leave the coast. I don't see why everyone's so nervy. Fog's fog."
"That's what I say," said Victor, climbing into the coach.
"It's just a mercy we finished blown away yesterday," said Dibbler. "All this is probably just something seasonal. Nothing to worry about at all."
"You said that before," said Sol. "You said it at least 5 times so far this morning."
Ginger was hunched on one seat, with Laddie lying underneath it. Victor slid along until he was next to her.
"Did you get any sleep?" he whispered.
"Just an hour or two, I think," she said. "Nothing happened. No dream or anything."
Victor relaxed.
"Then it's really over," he said. "I wasn't sure."
"And the fog?" she demanded.
"Sorry?" said Victor guiltily.
"What's causing the fog?"
"Well," said Victor, "as I understand it, when cool air passes over warm ground, water is precipitated out of..."
"You know what I mean. It's not like normal fog at all. It sort of drifts oddly,"
she finished lamely.
"And you can nearly hear voices," she added.
"You can't nearly hear voices," said Victor,
in the hope that his own rational mind would believe him. "You either hear them or you don't."
Listen, we're both just tired, that's all it is. We've been working hard and, not getting much sleep, so it's understandable that we think we're nearly hearing and seeing things.
Oh, so you're nearly seeing things, are you?
Said Ginger triumphantly.
And don't you go around using that calm and reasonable tone of voice on me, she added. I hate it when people go around being calm and reasonable at me.
I hope you two lovebirds aren't having a tiff.
Victor and Ginger stiffened. Dibbler clambered up into the opposite seat and leered encouragingly at them. Sol followed. There was a slam as the driver shut the carriage door.
We'll stop for a meal when we're halfway, said Dibbler, as they lurched forward.
He hesitated and then sniffed suspiciously.
What's that smell? He said.
I'm afraid my dog is under your seat, said Victor.
Is it ill? Said Dibbler.
I'm afraid it always smells like that.
Don't you think it would be a good idea to give it a bath?
A mutter on the edge of hearing said, Do you think it would be a good idea to have your feet bitten right off? Meanwhile, over Holywood, the fog thickened. The posters for Blown Away had been circulating in Ankh-Morpork for several days, and interest was running at fever pitch. They'd even got as far as the university this time. The librarian had one pinned up in the fetid, book-lined nest he called home. Well, in fact, he called it Ook, but probably in translation it meant home. And various others were surreptitiously circulating among the wizards themselves. The artist had produced a masterpiece. Held in Victor's arms, against the background of the flaming city, Ginger was portrayed as not only showing nearly all she had, but quite a lot of what she had not, strictly speaking, got. The effect on the wizards was everything that Dibbler could possibly have hoped for. In the uncommon room, the poster was passed from hand to shaking hand, as if it might explode.
There's a girl who's got it, said the Chair of Indefinite Studies.
He was one of the fattest wizards, and so overstuffed that he seemed to be living up to his title. He looked as though horsehair should be leaking from frayed patches. People felt an overpowering urge to rummage down the side of him for loose change.
"What's it, Chair?"
said another wizard.
You know, it, oomph, the old weh-heh-heh."
They watched him politely and expectantly, like people awaiting the punchline.
"Good grief. Do I have to spell it out?"
he said.
"He means sexual magnetism," said the lecturer in recent runes happily. "The lure of wanton soft bosoms and huge pulsating thighs and the forbidden fruits of desire, which—"
A couple of wizards carefully moved their chairs away from him.
"Ah, sex!"
said the Dean of Pentacles, interrupting the lecturer in recent runes in mid-sigh.
"Far too much of it these days, in my opinion."
"Oh, I don't know,"
said the lecturer in recent runes. He looked wistful. The noise woke up Wendell Poons, who had been dozing in his wheelchair by the fire. There was always a roaring fire in the uncommon room, summer or winter.
What's that?
He said. The Dean leaned towards an ear.
I was saying, he said loudly, that we didn't know the meaning of the word sex when we were young.
Well, that's true. That's very true, said Poons.
He stared reflectively at the flames.
Did we ever find out, do you remember?
There was a moment's silence.
Say what you like, she's a fine figure of a woman, said the lecturer in recent runes defiantly. Several young women, said the Dean.
Wendell Poons focused unsteadily on the poster.
Who's the young fella? He said.
What young fellow? Said several wizards.
He's in the middle of the picture, said Poons. He's holding her in his arms.
They looked again.
Him, said the chair dismissively.
Seems to me I've seen him before, said Poons. My dear Poons, I hope you haven't been sneaking off to the moving pictures, said the Dean, grinning at the others. You know, it's demeaning for a wizard to patronize the common entertainments. The Arch-Chancellor would be very angry with us.
What's that?
Said Poons, cupping a hand to his ear.
It does look a bit familiar now that you mention it, said the Dean, peering at the poster.
The lecturer in recent rooms put his head on one side.
"It's young Victor, isn't it?" he said.
"Eh?"
said Poons.
"You know, he could be right,"
said the chair of indefinite studies.
"He had the same type of weedy moustache."
"Who's this?"
said Poons.
"But he was a student. He could have been a wizard," said Dean. "Why would he want to go off and fondle young women?" "It's Victor, all right, but not our Victor. Says here he's Victor Maraschino," said the chair. "Oh, that's just a click name," said the lecturer in recent runes, airily. "They all have funny names like that. Dolores de Sin and Blanche Languish and Rock Cliff and so on."
He realized they were looking at him accusingly.
Or so I'm told," he added lamely, "by the porter. He goes to see a click nearly every night."
"What are you on about?"
said Poons, waving his walking stick in the air.
"The cook goes every night, too," said the chair. "So do most of the kitchen staff. You'll just try getting so much as a ham sandwich after 9 o'clock.
Just about everyone goes," said the lecturer. "Except us."
One of the other wizards peered intently at the bottom of the poster.
"It says here," he said, "A Saga of Passion and Broad Staircases in Ankh Morpork's Turbulent History."
"Ah, it's historical then, is it?" said the lecturer.
"And it says a epic love story that astounded goddesses and men."
"Oh, religious as well."
"And it says with a 1,000 elephants."
"Bah. Wildlife. Always very educational, wildlife,"
said the chair, looking speculatively at the dean. The other wizards were doing so too.
"It seems to me," said the lecturer slowly, "that no one could possibly object to senior wizards viewing a work of historical, religious, and wildiflorific interest."
"University rules are very specific," said the dean,
but not very enthusiastically.
"But surely only meant for the students," said the lecturer. "I can quite understand that students shouldn't be allowed to watch something like this. They'd probably whistle and throw things at the screen. But it couldn't seriously be suggested, could it, that senior wizards such as ourselves shouldn't examine this popular phenomenon?"
Poons's flailing walking stick caught the dean sharply across the back of his legs.
"I demand to know what everyone's talking about," he snapped.
"We don't see why senior wizards shouldn't be allowed to watch the moving pictures,"
bellowed the chair.
"Jolly good thing, too," snapped Poons. "Everyone likes to look at a pretty woman."
"No one mentioned anything about any pretty woman. We were far more interested in examining popular phenomenons,"
said the chair.
"Call it what you like,
cackled Windlepoons.
"If people see wizards strolling out of the gate and going into a common moving picture pit, they'll lose all respect for the profession," said the dean. "It's not even as if it's proper magic. It's just trickery."
"You know," said one of the lesser wizards thoughtfully, "I've always wondered exactly what these wretched cliques are. Some kind of puppet show, are they? Are these people acting on a stage? Or a shadow play?"
"See," said the chair, "we're supposed to be wise, and we don't even know."
They all looked at the dean.
"Yes, but who wants to see a lot of young women dancing around in tights?"
he said. Hopelessly.